I know you'll be alright, even when times get hard and you feel like you're in the dark. You will see just how beautiful life can be when you soften your heart. You can finally start to live your truthiest life.
Welcome back to The Truthiest Life. Today's guest is Kat Defada, who's an amazing eating disorder therapist, host of You Need Therapy podcast, one of my favorite podcasts. And Kat, you're also an indoor cycling instructor, I think.
I am that.
You do it all.
Well, I don't do it all, but I do a lot, I guess.
You do a lot for the mind, body, and spirit of everyone. You're a true healer.
For sure.
Well, thank you for everything that you do. If you're unfamiliar with Kat, she was one of our first guests on the podcast Outway that I co-host with Amy Brown. And she came on last year to talk about her style of therapy. And it was supposed to be like a quick episode. And I think we did like a full hour because we were like, we need to hear more from Kat.
I went into that being like, what are we going to talk about? And then I left like an hour later and I was like, what happened? That was supposed to be 20 minutes. It was so fun though.
It was so fun. And I think I cried. I remember feeling really seen by the things that you were saying, some of which we'll get into today. So you're based in Nashville. You work primarily with eating disorder clients, but you also do trauma and addiction as well, right?
Yeah, my specialty, one of my main specialty would be eating disorders, but it's probably at this point like 50% of my practice. And then the other 50% is a wide range of things, from stuff like trauma, anxiety, depression, life transitions, all this stuff.
And do you only work with people in Nashville, Tennessee, or you can do virtual?
I can do virtual, but they have to be in the state of Tennessee. Because my license is only in Tennessee.
Got it. Just in case anyone likes you here, well, either way, you're going to go and follow Kat. She puts great content out on social media and on your podcast as well, which I've personally benefited from. So
thank you.
Since this is The Truthiest Life and we don't really get to hear a lot about Kat the person in real life, you know, who you are behind the professional lens. You take a very personal approach to being a therapist, and not to say that, like, you know, you're super too professional out there.
Yeah.
But I want to know who Kat was when you're not a therapist and before you were a therapist. So let's start with your own story of what it was like to water down the parts of you that were you in order to please others.
I will say up front, I could be on a podcast all day talking about somebody else's story and talking about therapy and my profession. This is so much harder for me because of what you just said. I take a very personal approach to the work that I do, and I also am a professional, and it's the stuff I'm doing is usually not about me. So I will say I'm so excited to be here, and this is like probably one of the scariest podcasts in a good way, like not scary bad, but scary good. Yeah. So your question about me, if we go all the way back, I would say now I'm a pretty self-confident, self-assured. I know who I am, although that person continues to evolve. I let that happen. That was not always the case. And I like having that conversation because I do think that a lot of times, whether it's a client or just somebody on the internet, they see me now and they think that's just how she's always been. And oh my God, I have not always been this way at all.
Yeah, I think a lot of therapists in general are really hesitant for professional reasons to peel that layer back with their clients or with their now social media audiences. And obviously there's a level or there's a question that every professional needs to ask, which is why am I sharing this, right? Like if you're showing up and you're still in the midst of your healing as a therapist, maybe not appropriate.
Right.
But if there's a part of you that can make the other person feel like level the playing field a little bit of professional to patient, I think that that's really helpful because we're just bringing it back to being humans together, not professional at the desk taking a note, person on the patient on the couch crying, you know?
Right. Well, and I think that is important to say because, I mean, therapy's changed so much in the past however many years, but how I find healing and what I feel and what I've seen and what I know to believe about healing and the healing process is we heal through relationships. So if I'm not connecting with my clients, it's going to be really hard for me to help them find their healing process. And the same for me. Like, I think that kind of going back to the original question is it, growing up, trying to like figure out who I was or what I wanted or how to feel okay with myself, there was always an essence of me trying to do it alone without letting anybody know what was going on. And that never worked.
Did you struggle to fit in your home environment, in your school environment? Like, you know, what was so out of place for you?
I would say kind of all around. This has nothing to do with my family not being like loving and caring and supportive of me. They were very present, very there. But I always felt, based on stories I made up about my experiences, that I was kind of the less than. Like, I was almost like last place in my family and last place in my friend groups. And I also don't know why I even had that idea that there were places, but I did. And so I was loved and cared for, and I had friends, always had friends. That's what's really confusing, I think, is I've always been somebody who's been surrounded by a lot of people. But that, I think, is important because I've always been surrounded by a lot of people. But I also always felt kind of like either alone or I have to do something to keep them here.
I feel like I relate to that experience so much of alone despite being around other people. Mm-hmm. And I'll go a little bit further to specify feeling alone and scared, you know, not alone and empowered in any way, feeling like I need to do something to keep the people around. Mm-hmm. So you learned how to keep people around. What was your method of entertaining, for lack of a better word, those around you?
I did everything. Because here's the thing, things would work and then they wouldn't work anymore. And so my family is very athletic. We all played sports. Obviously, I still am a fitness instructor. I love all of that side of life. We all played sports. I played sports and they were fun, but I was never the best, ever. I was never like a star. I never was, but my older siblings were. So very young, as a defense, I think I took that role on of like, I'm never going to be that good. I had it in my head. I'm never going to be as good as my sister. I'm never going to be as good as my brother. I can't do that. I told myself that story. So clearly I didn't try as hard as I probably could have. And then I was like, so I have to do this other thing. So my other thing was, I'm going to be the smartest one in my family. And I'm somebody who I think is intelligent, but I'm not just naturally super, 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 super smart. Like, when I study for something or I want to learn something, I have to really pay a lot of attention to what I'm doing. It takes a lot of effort. So I became somewhat obsessive with school. And my family would joke about it. And it is like, in an essence, kind of funny, but I made a note card for everything, literally everything. I would even like, I would still do this later in my life. Like when I was studying for the GRE, there's a test you have to take to get into grad school. I made a note card for every single vocabulary word in the back of the book, which is like probably 1,000, and studied them for months until I knew every single word.
I'm laughing only because I'm the exact same way. Like you said, I consider myself intelligent, but where I really excel, and I think you really excel, is like emotional intelligence, reading the room, reading people, reading my own emotions. When it comes to studying, I can do it, but I had to learn how to do it. And it was obsessive. I'm the type of person, I don't know if you're the same, where I'm either going to get like a D or F on the test because I don't understand the material, or I'm going to get 100% because I studied so hard.
When you know that turned, when I was younger, it was, there was a couple things that I did, but one of them was this obsessive studying of like vocabulary words for spelling tests or this or that, like obsessive. And I was diagnosed, I think I was in third grade, like I was diagnosed with OCD because that's what it looked like. Looking back, as a mental health professional, I was diagnosed by my like general doctor. As a mental health professional, I look back and I see something very different. I don't see OCD. I see anxiety, which OCD is an anxiety disorder, but I see that as a way to cope with something else. So that's what that looked like at that point. I mean, I remember getting my first B on my report card and I locked myself in my room and I like cried because I thought that I wasn't going to get into college. Because I got a B on a report card one time. Anyway, so that happens. And then, so that's part of my identity. Then it goes into, and I'll just cover this quickly it goes into like, I'm going to be the funny one, or I'm going to be this one, or I'm going to be, I mean, I tried out all these identities to make sure I had kind of my own thing, because what I saw was my family has this thing. They're athletic. That's their thing. That's who they are. That's why they're so great. That's whatever. And I needed my thing. Now I know that's not, your identity isn't found in one singular part of who you are. So there's the smart cat. How I explain this with clients now is I explain this whole thing of looking like a Hydra head. Do you know what a Hydra head monster is? Like Greek. Okay. So it's this like Greek mythological creature that has one human head and then like all these like immortal heads. And when you cut one head off, like two more grow from it. And it's really easy to see this when I draw it, but so just like go with me in your head. So there's this like one immortal head and there's all these heads and we're cutting off all these immortal heads. And that is the school, that is the sports, that is the being the funny one, that is being this one, that's the eating disorder, the addiction, so whatever. We're just keep cutting those things off and paying attention to those things. When really looking back, what I wish I would have known, but I'm grateful for the trajectory of my story, what I wish I would have known is that I really need to pay attention to the mortal head, which was the story I had and the shame I held and all of that stuff. And if I would have taken care of that part of me, then I wouldn't need all of this stuff that I'm trying to kind of essentially distract myself with.
You brought me back to in college, there was this girl who, one of my best friends, and she was the funniest person. She was so freaking funny. And people liked her because she was funny. And they'd say, "You're so funny." And I remember one time her being like crying, having a breakdown. And she's like, "They only like me because I'm funny." And I was so confused by it at the time because it was like her flex. It was her, how she could, you know, walk into any room and turn any type of person into somebody that was interested in her. And it seemed like such a desirable trait and what she wanted to be leading with. But hearing what you're saying, it sounds like that was one of her, you know, immortal heads that she protruded and was afraid to show up as the real her, who, yes, sure, she's funny, but she's not just funny. Is that kind of...
Yeah, because it, like that was one of, yeah, that was definitely one of my things too. And there is a lot of pressure in that. It's fun to be funny. Like, I think that is part of who I am, but there's pressure if that's how I'm getting value and that's how I'm able to show up. And that's why I think people solely like me. Then do I always have to be funny all the time? What happens when I'm not? What happens when I'm tired? And you know, I just went on a trip with a bunch of high school friends. And what my high school friends don't know about me, because I don't really talk about this, is that I had a lot of anxiety going to that trip because I have a lot of gratitude and just like care and grace and love for the version of me that was the cat in high school. For how I showed up, it wasn't always the best. I didn't always show up the best in high school. Not that I was a horrible person, but one, I'm in high school and I have the brain of a 16-year-old and the emotional intelligence of a 16-year-old. So there's that. But how I think people see me based on how I think my friends remember me from high school is one way based on their interpretation of the outside of what they saw. My interpretation of myself in high school is a really sad, hurt, scared human. And I don't love all the things that showed up in high school, how I showed up all the time. I mean, I wasn't like horrible all the time, but I didn't always show up appropriately or how I wish I would have. But I know that girl differently than I think a lot of the people that I was around knew that girl. So I had all this anxiety going back and seeing all these people because in my head, they're still essentially judging my behavior and what I looked like based on who I am now. If does that make sense?
Are these people that you regularly see, even though it's been a bunch of years since high school?
Some of them, but most of them not. These people love me. I mean, there's not like these people are like, obviously I went and spent time with them, so they're friends with me. But I have a hard time going, and it's nothing about them. I have a hard time going back to places that remind me of those hard places, if that makes sense.
Where there was this big disconnect between what you were feeling and how others saw you.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example of this is I was sitting there with one of my good girlfriends from high school, a guy friend, and then a girl that didn't know me in high school and I just recently met. And, or there's two of my good friends from high school. And one of the girls asked the guy, he was to tell the new girl, the new friend, "Hey, what was your interpretation of us in high school? Like, what was our reputation? I like looking back on this stuff. And I said, please don't do that. Like, please don't do that. And they're like, why? That's so fun. Like, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't want to know. I do not have any interest in knowing what you thought about me in high school inside of your head. I don't want to know that. That's none of my business. And he, the guy was super awesome. And he was like, yeah, if you don't want me to tell you, I'm not like, I'm going to respect that. But I say that to express that like high school was a really, really hard time for me. And people didn't know that because I didn't show up that way. I showed up as funny or catty or judgmental or this or that. I showed up as smart. I did show up as athletic. I showed up as all these ways, but they didn't see is behind the scenes, me inside of my head scrambling to feel okay.
Right. So, I mean, it wasn't that you didn't want to hear what they had to say so much as perhaps in this moment, like you weren't available in the safest of spaces, maybe even physically and around these people to go back to the pain that you felt, really.
Yeah. Like, I think, yes.
I think it probably came off as more defensive or to the outside person of like, I don't really care what you have to say, but really it was a protection method of in this very moment, I'm not able to visit that part of me because that's going to derail me for the rest of the weekend, maybe.
Part of the reason I even bring that up is because I think a lot of times we look at people's behavior, we look at how people are showing up, and we are super quick to judge them as good or bad, right or wrong, nice, mean, this, that, when really there's something underneath of all of our behaviors. Like there's something underneath that. And yeah, I was in high school, so I was like emotionally immature in one sense. Also, there was something underneath my behavior that I was too scared to let anybody in on. Because if I did, what would that mean?
It's pretty cool that even as a people pleaser, you kind of just became a version of you that would make other people happy in that moment. When you were brought back to that environment and those people, you did not revert to people pleasing. You said, please don't. I don't want to do that. Where, I don't know, I feel like I could relate in some ways where when I'm around people from the past, I water myself down a little bit for the sake of being easy, being easygoing. I also want to say that like in a world where we're really addicted to information, especially when it's self-serving information. You know, if we could see our letters of recommendation or things that like we're not supposed to see, we really want to know what other people think about us. So for you in that moment to say, no, I actually don't need to know what you thought about me there is a really powerful, a self-discipline practice to protect yourself. And I think everyone can kind of take something from that when it comes to, oh, I really want to know how this person feels about me, whether it's either asking your friend, what did she say about me? What did he say about me? You know, can you just let that be?
Well, yeah, because what I learned later in my story is that other people's opinions of me are none of my business. And I really believe that because as my story goes on, the more I allowed myself to connect to myself and actually appreciate myself and me create my own opinion of myself, the less I had to worry about me showing up in certain ways. And so 100%, like I'm very, very careful in my adult life not to overload myself with that information because it can be really harmful and hard and it's unnecessary.
I feel like I struggle with that as like a later in life social media presence where I used to really not care about people's opinions of me. And then I started to attach to people's opinions of me, especially in the last year or two, which is interesting because I don't know, I feel like I hit 30. I didn't care, you know, like I was strong. I knew what I was doing. And then maybe the culture of the last couple of years, I became a little bit more affected by of how people thought of me. It's really empowering for me to hear you say that other people's opinions of me are none of my business.
Yeah, I didn't learn that in like a month. I learned that in probably the span of 8 years. But it's been one of the most helpful lessons. And I think to your point, social media is hard. Anybody feels like it's their right to share their opinion about you with you. And it's hard to have, it is way harder to have the discipline in that to not read stuff.
And you don't know that they're going to be doing it. You open the message and then they're like, well, I you disappointed me when you said this. I'm I didn't ask for it. But now that I know this, it's, you know, it's like a hard place. So it's interesting as you two do social media. Do you find yourself ever crawling back to that place where you are affected by the opinions of others?
I mean, of course, when I see something, it can be an initial, oh, okay, I didn't really want that. Now I'm reading it, I know it. But what I also have learned to believe and learn to know is that if we're being authentic, if I'm being myself, if I'm being Kat, like if I'm being like who I was created to be at my core, there's no way everybody's going to like me. It's not possible. Somebody's going to think I'm going to do something wrong. Somebody's going to think I said something wrong. Somebody's going to think I shouldn't have shared that, or I should have shared more. Somebody's going to think that I'm ugly. Somebody's going to think I'm beautiful. Somebody's going to like my body. Somebody's going to think my body's disgusting. If I am showing up as myself, somebody is not going to like it. And that is literally just a fact. Now, if I wanted everybody to like me, I could probably find a way to manipulate myself every day and please people. But that would be so painful. That pain is not worth it to me.
Yeah, so true. And going back to your point of, you know, you said I could say something wrong. I could do something wrong. You will do something wrong that you find wrong. You know, you'll look back and say, oh, I wish I didn't say that, or I could have said it better the way I feel I have. But it's interesting to think about the other people, how you said everybody sees things in black and white. I like this person. I don't like this person. They're nice. They're mean. How quick people are to define us by those one moments when we all have those one moments. Okay, so going back to your story a little bit, how did you crawl out of this people-pleasing mentality? You know, how did you find your sense of self-worth and I'm going to be Kat whether you like it or not?
Well, and again, this goes back to like, it's none of my business, but there's this assumption that I have that other people would have thought that I was always this way because I have always been, I have been outspoken in a sense, but not outspoken in the most truest, authentic way that I would be now. But so I have this experience in high school, all over the place, whatever. I tell myself at the end of high school, I am starting over. I want to start over. I want a new slate of people. I want a new community. I want to go somewhere where people don't have a preconceived judgment on me based on who I have been in my past. So I decided to go to a school that nobody, it ended up being a very random school, but nobody in my high school went to. And so I got to do that. My sister went to that school, and that's how I even knew to apply to it. So I went to college and I got to start over with a whole new group of people. Now, here's the thing. Wherever you go, there you are. So I brought my insecure, I need to feel XYZ about being the human I am. I need validation in this way. I brought that person to college with me. So that's turned into my I have to be the smartest, I have to be the funniest, turned into I have to be success. I still had to be the smartest. You better believe I had like over a 4.0 in college because I needed to have that. But I had to be like the most involved in my sorority, and I had to do this. And I was like the vice president and the this chair and then that chair and the to show up to these events. And I have to be the best Christian and the best this. And I did that for so long. In the middle of that, while that's happening, what I don't know is happening is I'm exhausted and I'm coping with food. And I don't even know I'm doing that until one day I wake up and I'm like, what is going on with my body? Like I felt like, so this is not my body.
What about your body didn't feel like it? It was changing. It was uncomfortable.
It definitely changed. And I was an athlete growing up. So I always played sports. I always, whatever. And so I go to college and I'm not doing that. And so I'm not moving and I'm losing that authentic part of me. So I wake up one day and I think part of this wake up is mixed in with like the diet culture and wanting to fit in that too. It's like, I didn't like what my body looked like, but I also didn't like what my body felt like. And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna tackle that now. And because I like to do things the best, I'm going to tackle it the best way. I'm going to go full force and I'm going to, you know, how that whole world works. So it starts with, I'm going to pay attention to what I'm eating and I'm going to start moving my body. And then it turns into, I'm counting every morsel of a calorie that's entering my body. And I am basing my life around working out. Well, I was really great at that. And that became my identity in that sense. I was like the most disciplined and I had the most willpower and I had this body that everybody was complimenting me on and I was so strong and athletic and that became who I was. So that's me at the end of college. Granted, I will say my college experience was awesome. With that, it was hard and I had some obviously hard identity moments, but I met some really great people that I'm still really good friends with. My whole college experience wasn't ruined. It actually, I kind of want to say it like ended worse than it started. because it ended with me in the depths of what I didn't know was an eating disorder.
Yeah, I'd say same. And I'd also still also say that I left college. So, yeah. I mean, you know, it, looking back, it's colored by this anxious, disordered eating, didn't know it, you know, this person that's not me really, or, but at the same time, I mean, I still loved college. I loved my friends. Mm-hmm. I, you know, so many parts of it were great. So mm-hmm. I think that's important when we hear somebody's eating disorder story though, that they also didn't get some, you know, enjoyment out of the life that they were living, especially when you didn't really know that you were struggling. Like I didn't know I was struggling.
Yeah. Because like, here's the thing that I believe about any kind of addictive process, and even this like Hydra Head thing, I was really struggling for sure. But all these things that I picked up also were solutions to a problem, and they all worked until they stopped working. So my eating disorder worked for a period of time really well. And I was super happy until it didn't work anymore. And it was literally consuming my life. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it was doing that until after I graduated. So I say that to piggyback off of what you said, like, yeah, these things weren't great, but to an extent, they worked for periods of time. And because of that, I do have a weird sense of gratitude for the little like things that I picked up along the way to survive.
And so after college, did you find your way into therapy? What was your breakthrough?
Here's the thing, which I think you can relate to. I was like so high and mighty. I thought that I was like killing it. Like I wanted to switch my degree at the end of when I was graduating. I was like, I want to become a dietitian because I want to help people. And I want to like essentially like save people's lives and help people lose weight and find the life they've always wanted. That's what I wanted to do. And I thought I had the secret. And so I didn't do that. I graduated with my degree and then I went to the program that I had planned to go to, which was a counseling program. But I told myself, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to combine this. I'm going to be a therapist, but I'm going to work with eating disorders, and I'm only going to work with binge eating disorder, and I'm going to help people lose weight.
People need to see your facial reaction there.
I know. But it's like, if I could go back, I'd like cringe at that. But also I don't, because I didn't know. I mean, I was sick. I didn't know that that was not the way. And the light and the truth.
Could we pause for 1 second? Because I see a lot of that on social media. Coaches, sometimes dietitians, but lots of people I'll find my way to their pages and they are talking about food freedom, eating disorder recovery, and weight loss all in the same breath. And I don't know, when I was first even, you know, really getting into my philosophy, I was so angered by them and so thinking that they were so, I don't like the word stupid, but it's like the only word that's coming to me for the moment. And I would be, you know, cynical about it online and stuff. And I see a lot of people being cynical about these types of accounts online. And at the same time, it's like that person's going through something. I mean, I don't like that they are causing harm to who they're affecting because they're reaching people. But I think we have to start with recognizing that that person is in their moment of suffering. And I've seen so many people that were in that place leave that place and recognize what they were doing and get their own help and either change their messaging and into how they help people or abandon the whole thing together. But I just wanted to take a second because I think we see a lot of bad people on the internet. And like, what does that mean? Going back to your original question of good versus bad, you know, where are they in their process?
Yeah, you know, I'm with you in that. It used to boil my blood to such an extreme when I would see that, and I still see it. But since leaning into my story and finding gratitude for that version of me, it's the same thing of like, I want to offer them grace. I do struggle with the fact that like, it is so dangerous.
That's the thing. Yeah, I feel it. But are you going to combat that by making, you know, cynical memes about them?
Oh, no. Right? Yeah. That's not helpful. That's not helpful. Because if you did that to me back in the day, I would be like, you're just jealous.
Exactly.
You're jealous of my great life. Of exactly. Like, I found the light and you get. So I also know that like those people aren't always in a space to hear and understand that stuff. And it's like, okay, which I've talked about this on social media of like, what we can do in those moments is we can show up with our truth. We can show up and be kind and welcoming. And that will be attractive to people. Because in my story, there became a point where I've got it figured out. My life is so great. Like, I want to help people have this life turned into, I cannot do this anymore. Like, I can't. And this actually, I don't know, I'm crying. I don't ever really cry about this, but like, it turned into like me waking up in the morning and being like, oh my God, I have to do it again. Like, I have to do it again. Like, I have to, like, make sure I don't eat anything, and I have to, like, find an excuse to not go to that party, and I have to get myself to the gym, and then I have to run after I go to the gym. And, like, social media wasn't as big back then. Thank freaking God.
Yeah, same.
But I also was living this life and then trying to show everybody that I was really happy. And that, I mean, it was exhausting. It was exhausting. I think that through my whole story, from the elementary school me who was bullied on a playground to the high school me to the college me, it was that version of me that I was like, I cannot, this cannot be what life is. If this is what life is, and I will say I never was suicidal, I've never contemplated that, but I had those moments of like, if this is what life is, like, I'm not in. This is not it for me. So there came a moment where I was like, I have to be honest. It was very hard.
So honest with yourself, right. Honest with your family.
Well, honest with myself, first of all, because I mean, I lied to myself, but I think there was those moments of like, I didn't even like going to sleep because then I knew the next thing I was going to do was wake up and have to do it again, which is a crazy, I mean, I shouldn't use the word crazy, but it's a really sad, hard thought to look back on that. Like, I didn't want to go to bed and rest because I knew if I rested, I would have to get up and do this whole life again.
That's how exhausting it is to be trying so hard.
So luckily in my program, meanwhile, I just want people to know that, like, as this is happening, I'm in grad school to become a therapist. And so this is why it is so freaking important for therapists to do their own work. In our program, we had to go to therapy to graduate. There are some programs that don't require that, and I think it should be a requirement because of things like this. But I was already in therapy, and I had a therapist that I clearly was lying to. And I woke up one day, and I don't have a distinct memory of the day or whatever, but I just do know I woke up one day and I was like, I have to be honest. Like, I have to tell people that, like, I'm feeling this way, because now I know if I don't acknowledge something, I can't heal it, but I had to acknowledge something so I could heal it. So that's where that started. And it just started with myself being like, this isn't what you think it is. And then telling somebody else. I didn't share a lot of my story, which I'm okay with. And I think was what I needed to do. I didn't share what my struggle with a lot of friends and my family. I kind of worked on it with the community of support that I created. And then as I became more connected with myself and okay with sharing parts of my story, I did. This process has been 10 years. So this was all 10 years ago. And so now I'm really open with it. But I think a lot of times another thing I see on social media is people sharing their journey as it's unfolding. That's fine if that works for you. I don't always think that's the best way, because for many reasons. That's another reason I'm glad social media wasn't a big thing when I was going through this, because I didn't have pressure to share that. But it was a very personal thing for me to have for myself. And it still is.
There's one thing to share your story in therapy as you're going through it or privately. There's definitely another thing to share it as you're going through it, like you said, for a lot of reason, the validation that comes from it, looking for the validation.
Yeah.
As well as the internet isn't the safest space to hold a container for you to go to those places, especially in the last few years.
Well, and like the thing about the work I was doing and the work I still have to do is it's just not linear. Like I had that moment where I woke up but then I had moments when I was like, screw that. Like, I'm going back. Like, it wasn't like I had this like light bulb and then everything was better and I just talked about it with a therapist. It was a fight and a battle where I would have really great weeks, months, days, and then I'd have really bad weeks, months, and days. And my eating disorder wasn't just one thing. I hit them all. Every single behavior that you can think of, I tried it. And I did these behaviors and then they didn't work. And so I did these ones. It was all over the place. If I was sharing that with the world as it was unfolding, one, that just would be bad. But two, the other thing that you said, I don't want the validation that I would receive for that work to now be my new thing, mm-hmm. my new head.
Yep.
I needed to find a place where I can sit with myself, be with myself, be honest about who I was. I'm not the best athlete. I'm not the best this. I'm not the best that. I'm good at a lot of things. That's okay. I had to sit with myself and learn how to accept me before I grabbed onto other people's acceptance of me.
And it's such an important thought that I think most people don't formulate before taking it to social media, which is a vehicle right now, you know, because it just feels good. It feels right, especially when people are telling you that you're helping them, which may be true, but it's a little bit, you know, tainted if it's not truly helping you, the person. Yeah.
Well, in recovery of any sort, of any kind of healing process, what I really want people to know is that it's okay to be selfish. Your process is your process. So yeah, I might help people now sharing my story and doing what I do. And part of the work I do is because of my personal experience, but that's a whole separate thing. When I was healing myself, it was like laser vision. You have to take care of yourself, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to do the stuff I'm doing now. I authentically wouldn't. I would be causing harm.
And you're such an amazing therapist. I want everyone to go back and listen to, I think it was our first episode of Outway, if you go back to the Outway podcast, where you talk about how you work with people, specifically eating disorders, because it was so eye-opening for me. So if anybody's interested, go to Outway. It's one of the first few episodes back of March 2020. It really stuck with me. So let's just move into our final topic today, which is the stigma of being single in your 30s and living in the South. I know this is something you're comfortable talking about, and I think it's, if not a stigma, something a lot of people deal with, if not in the South, really everywhere. So I'd love to hear, you know, as somebody who has molded themselves into being so many different versions of you to attract different people and make them stay, how do you navigate being single, having the stigma that comes with it, as you say, and staying authentic to who you are?
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad that we're going to talk about this, because I'm very passionate about it. What I hear a lot in my office over and over and over and over again with my clients who are amazing human beings is this: what's wrong with me? I'm this age and I've never dated somebody, or I'm this age and I'm not married, or what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And I want to make it my mission, one of my missions in the world, in life, to make people believe that nothing is wrong with them based on their dating life. Mm. Like, that doesn't mean that has no bearing on your worth or your value or any of that. It is hard to actually understand that and comprehend that. We can think that and not feel it in our hearts. And that has been a struggle. And we didn't talk about this, but I didn't have my first like real date until after I graduated college. I never got asked to prom either year. I was always invited to date parties in college, but I always was like the like second date, or my like my friend's boyfriend would be like, we want Kat to come, like let's get her. But I never was like the one that was like essentially pursued in that way. And that was really hard for me. And I made up a lot of stories about it. And I didn't have my first romantic, serious boyfriend until I was like 26 or 27, which I don't think is that old, but in the world that I was living in, was essentially. So that's been a struggle. And that was a lot of my work and my talk, is I based a lot about what I thought about me off of those facts. These things mean I am not good enough. These things mean I am not worthy of. Because I don't have this, this means I have to better myself in this way or this way or this way. I don't believe that anymore. I just don't. I believe that like my life and my dating life and all of that, while I might not like it and I wouldn't choose this, maybe I wouldn't change it now, but if I were to go backwards in life, I wouldn't choose this trajectory. So I might not like it. I do know that there's a lot of power and value and meaning and purpose in me being not dating who I'm dating, not dating who I'm dating. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
what I'm saying.
It makes a lot of sense. I think it's really hard to uncouple, like you said, that worth from dating, especially when you get into your mid-20s, at least in New York, you know, when dating's such a prominent thing. And then, you know, it's like, did he like me? Did he not like me? Did he call me? Did he text me? And then you don't even realize it, but, you know, your worthiness is contingent on somebody who you may or may not have even liked yourself.
Yes. Yes, 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 Lisa. Oh, my gosh. So much of what I see and what I used to do is I want to get them to like me before I decide if I like them. Like, what the heck?
Totally.
Like, that makes no sense to me. And the thing is, if I was still living that way, people might like me, but not for me. And I would rather be in a relationship later in my life with somebody who really sees me and values me and knows me, where I get to just show up as me, than me get married at 23 like I thought I was going to. Mm. which there's nothing wrong with getting married at 23. A lot of my friends did. A lot of my family members did. But if I would have gotten married at 23, somebody would be marrying somebody that I wasn't.
Totally. Can't even imagine if I got married at 23, if who I'd marry, what I was like, the amount of baggage that I would be dragging in that I had not yet cleared out, sifted through, and healed. Oh my gosh. I would be in... not because of myself, I would be in an abusive relationship just because of the chaos that I know that I would bring in.
Yeah. And I mean, yes, going back to like one of my earliest relationships is I stayed in a relationship that was not healthy just because I needed to be in a relationship, like because that meant something. And if I know for a fact, God's hand was like over me in the ending of that relationship. But I know if I would have stayed in that relationship, I would not have the things that I have in my life. And I would not know the human that I get to know now. You would not get to know this person because she would not be a person. Right. She would be hiding somewhere. And so I can find so much gratitude, not for the traumatic experiences of that relationship. I will never be grateful for that. Mm. But I'm grateful for the life that I get to live now outside of that, because that's over.
Beautiful. So on that note, we'll close out for today. And I want to just encourage everybody to go check out your podcast. Mm-hmm. I'll link that below. You talk about really everything. Recently, you answered a question from a listener about how to talk about sex with your therapist. And as somebody who's been in therapy my entire life, I think that's was just such a great question. I really enjoyed that episode. And it's just a great podcast. You talk about everything from eating disorders to trauma to answering listener questions like that. And it's called You Need Therapy. I'm going to link that below and Kat's info so you can check out her practice if you're in the Tennessee area, or just her Instagram if you want to see some of the amazing things that Kat's doing. Thank you, Kat. And thank you for sharing so authentically today.
Of course. Thank you.